Good evening. Welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. My name is Dan Shustak, your host for this spring seminar series. This annual lecture series is funded by MCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the MCLA Foundation. Each spring, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to MCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to research and management of invasive species in our state, region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lecture will be posted at mcla.edu/greenliving. Tonight's presentation will last around 50 minutes, and then we'll have some time for question and answers at the end. Tonight's speaker is Chris Bulow. Chris Bulow is the restoration ecologist for the Massachusetts Natural Heritage and Endangered Species Program, where he has spent the last 16 years restoring and managing rare species habitats and important natural communities across the Commonwealth. His work involves the identification, assessment, and prioritization of the state's rare and imperiled resources, as well as the planning, implementation, and monitoring of needed conservation actions for these resources. During his time with the Heritage Program, Chris has worked in a wide range of communities, from the calcareous wetlands of the Berkshires to the barrens of Cape Cod and the islands, as well as with a broad range of rare and highly specialized species, including invertebrates, plants, and birds. Prior to this position, Chris spent a decade working across the United States on a variety of avian research and management projects, primarily focused on endangered species. He currently lives in Hardwick, Massachusetts, with his family, where he spends much of his spare time exploring the ecology of the local landscape. Let's welcome Chris to MCLA.
Well, thanks, Dan. And as you mentioned, my name is Chris Bulow, restoration ecologist with the Massachusetts Endangered Species Program. And I actually have a lot of slides tonight, so I'm going to jump right into this, make sure that we don't go over the allotted hour. And before we jump into the main topic, I just want to give some background of where I work and how I work to give some context to what we're going to be talking about tonight. So I work for the Natural Heritage and Endangered Species Program, which, as the logo suggests, is a subunit of the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife. And our main mission at the Heritage Program is the protection of the state's native biodiversity, with a specific emphasis on the state's rare and endangered species, particularly those species listed under the Massachusetts Endangered Species Act. Our program is based in Westboro, but we're statewide, and we have a staff of approximately 30, and we're divided up into three segments. We have an environmental review staff whose main function is to administer and enforce the Mass Endangered Species Act. We have our data staff, who processes all the data associated with rare species in the state, and the science staff. And I'm part of the science staff. We're approximately 10 people, and most people within the science staff are somewhat specific in their areas of expertise. State botanist, state herpetologist, invertebrate zoologist, and as of right now, I'm the only ecologist in the program. Hopefully that will change soon, but my position is restoration ecologist, and often people ask me, well, what is a restoration ecologist? And it's a pretty good question. And I think the simplest answer that I can come up with is my role with the program is to manage the landscapes that support the most vulnerable species and natural communities in the Commonwealth. So while much of our staff is focused either on particular species or assemblages of species, my role within that group is to take a step back, look at the landscape, and think about it from a management perspective. So for a little context, I know that this is an invasive species presentation, and we're going to get to that, but I think the part that intrigues me most about this presentation and its title is actually the second half of that title, which is managing regional biodiversity. So going to spend a little time talking about that first, kind of to set context, because I think it's important to get a feel for how we're actually thinking about the management on a landscape level. And one of the most important questions that I keep going back to is, what is the main reason that most of our species in the state are rare in the first place? I think understanding that question is one of the keys to inform how you actually enact your management and set your priorities moving forward within a program, especially if you're looking from a regional perspective. Thinking about the Massachusetts Endangered Species Act, one of the most common threads is that the majority of rare species in Massachusetts are rare because they specialize in natural communities that are rare. And what that means is it's really ecosystems and habitats that are driving rare species and species distribution across the state to begin with. The two are linked, and as we get deeper into this, you're going to see I keep going back to natural communities and ecosystems. That's really the driver of the system. And we're talking about rarity. One of the real common threads about why species are rare in the state is most of them are specialists. They specialize in some component of the ecosystem that is often rare. It could be plants, an unusual chemical makeup of the soil influenced by the bedrock. It could be a suite of species that are influenced by a natural disturbance regime like fire. But whatever the reason is, there's something very specific that they're keying into. Habitat drives that. And for these rare habitats, it's those specialists with them that are rare to begin with. That's why these species are rare. So from a historical context, we think about rarity. Back that up a little bit. In the modern day, when we think about rarity, there's sort of this bias to that. It's a problem if it's rare. It's threatened. It's on the edge. But from a historical context, that's not necessarily the case. It's more of a reflection of these are species that were exploiting a very specific niche. And that niche has persisted through time. It happens to be a rare niche. Therefore, the species are rare. So thinking about rarity and rare biodiversity in those terms is a really important cue in thinking about how to deal with rarity in the modern world. But inevitably, we are in the modern world, so we kind of have to think about how these things come together. So if we think about rare biodiversity today in the state, I don't think this is that bold of a statement to say that the primary immediate threat to rare species and overall biodiversity in Massachusetts is habitat loss. I think most people who are dealing with conservation would agree that that really is the driver for endangered species and threats to population in the state. But I'd like to take it a little bit deeper because I think this is a little bit too broad to look at. It's an important viewpoint to assess what's happening, but I think there's a lot more to what's happening, especially when we're talking about habitat management in the state. So the first question to ask is, what is habitat loss? I think the consensus answer to that question, what is habitat loss? I think most people would say would be development. I think that would be the easy answer to give. And when you think about the landscape and you look at a figure like this, that becomes really kind of obvious in a lot of ways. This is a pretty depressing slide, but it's also pretty telling of what happened to a lot of our landscape in this state. This is less than 50 years in Falmouth on Cape Cod, and you can see wide open, fairly natural landscape here, and then in less than 50 years, we have this high-density suburbanization. Really, no one could argue that that's direct habitat loss. That is really driving species rarity in the state. However, I would make the argument that that's only half of the issue that we're dealing with. The other half, and this really comes into what I deal with as a restoration ecologist on the landscape, is indirect habitat loss. I feel that indirect habitat loss in the state is at least an equal threat to biodiversity. And what I mean by indirect habitat loss is things that are happening on the landscape that's changing those habitats and ecosystems. So if we can picture a piece of protected open space, that's habitat protection or land conservation, but it's what's happening on that landscape that actually really matters. It's the second part of the story. So if we go back to why are species rare in the state, and if we accept the fact that most species are rare because they depend on some rare aspect within the ecosystem, then it sort of leads us to the next level of thinking about how to manage and protect biodiversity. It's protecting those aspects. And what I really see in my work, looking at this issue across the state, is that there's two major forms of indirect habitat loss happening in the state. The first is a rising dominance of non-native species in the habitat. Most often that's invasive species, but not always. And this figure over here, this is bur oak, this tree. It's a very rare species in the state, and it's surrounded by non-native invasive Phragmites. So I think this example illustrates that pretty well. Indirect habitat loss. So you have a rare species on the landscape. This happens to be on protected open space. The land is protected, but the natural processes aren't functioning the way that they should be anymore because we have invasive dominance here. This plant may survive as an individual, but its reproductive capabilities are pretty much gone because the invasives have made it so it's not going to be more generations following it. So you have the species on the landscape, you have the land protected from a conservation perspective, but it's not functioning as an ecosystem anymore. Indirect habitat loss. And the second major aspect of indirect habitat loss that I deal with is a disruption of important natural processes. And a few examples here, fire, beaver activity, ice scour, things that on a regular frequency happen on the landscape that cause disturbance that certain species have adapted to and actually have become to rely upon. And this is a completely different presentation, but fire is a huge driver of these systems historically across the state, especially on the coastal plain and in our interior river valleys. And in the absence of fire, we're seeing the same impacts. Indirect habitat loss, fire suppression is changing succession and resulting in loss of biodiversity. And I think I would summarize this idea with this bottom sentence. And I think this is a really important take home when thinking about conservation in general, especially on a regional landscape. And that's the idea that while it's critical to protect land that supports rare species, ignoring the causes of indirect habitat loss on those parcels undermines the intent of that protection. So the idea is you may protect a piece of land, put it in conservation with the intention of protecting that rare biodiversity, but unless you're allowing for those natural processes to happen, or if you're not dealing with some immediate threat like invasive species, those conservation efforts are in the end going to be for nothing because you're going to lose those species from that landscape anyway. So conservation is really a two-tiered movement. It's land protection, it's critical, but if you have resources that depend on some of these aspects, then you really do need to follow that up with management or your initial intentions for protecting those resources will be lost. So in the program, I'm actually fortunate that my philosophy that's being played out in this slide is really shared by my colleagues. And that's the idea that we almost never approach rare species management through the lens of single species management. The idea is that we look at the actual ecosystem and ecosystem functions, and if we can get those ecosystems to function properly, so to speak, then the rare species conservation should almost inherently follow. To give an example, species X, if we're seeing a decline of an occurrence of a particular species on a landscape, and I go visit that landscape and try to figure out what we do to slow that decline, 9 times out of 10, my management prescription is not going to involve actually dealing with that particular species. It's going to involve getting that ecosystem, that natural community functioning, with the idea that when that community is functioning, that species will thrive. And not only will that species thrive, but the other specialists that are also relying on those functions will also be bolstered. And that whole interrelationship will function once again. Really quickly, looking at these two photos, and I'll back up just a little bit. I keep saying natural communities, and that's a presentation all unto itself. But when I say natural communities, just think ecosystems. A natural community is basically a predictable assemblage of plants that are reflecting an environmental condition. And we have some very rare examples of those in the state that we're concerned about. When we talk about natural communities in this context, just think ecosystems. It's a little bit easier to visualize. But these are two examples here of the same natural community, an open calcareous fen. Southern Berkshire County is kind of the heart of this, but these are globally rare ecosystems and very rare in Massachusetts and real hotspots for biodiversity. If we had one species that was called to our attention in this example that was declining, and if I was to look at this, it would be very clear to me, and I think you don't have to be really an ecologist to look at these two examples and figure out which one is functioning well and which is not. A hint, the one on the left is not functioning well. And the reason this is not functioning well is it's being overwhelmed by invasive species, and it's had that natural disturbance process interrupted. These are fire-influenced communities. This place hasn't seen fire in a very long time. As a result, generalist species have moved in and overwhelmed it. On the right, this is an area that has burnt within the last decade, and we have been actively managing invasive species, and you can see not only species richness, structure, and composition looks really fantastic in this example, but the species are here are the highly specialized rare species that we're going for. So to go back to that example, if we had, say, a rare plant in this system that was about to drop out of the system, my first thought would not be, how am I going to manage that rare plant? It would be, how do I get this to look like this? It's thinking about it from an ecosystem perspective, getting the function back onto that landscape. And by doing that, these plants and these rare species are so resilient that often that's all it takes. Most of our rare species are disturbance dependent, which means that they need some sort of disturbance to persist. Often that's fire. And those types of species, for example, seed bank really well. So their seeds will last in the soil for decades, just waiting for the next opportunity for some disturbance event to come through and start the process over. If we were to run a fire through here, plants that we have never observed in our lifetime, rare, highly specialized plants, would almost be guaranteed to come back because that's how they're built to respond to disturbance cycles. So I feel like I'm already falling way behind in this, so I'm going to speed things up even more. But I think this is kind of an important idea when thinking about, again, managing for regional biodiversity. We have a big state. We have 432 species listed under the Massachusetts Endangered Species Act, 73 of these priority natural communities across the state, 570 swap species, which are essentially species of high conservation concern, and a statewide mission. We have a science staff of 10 people. I'm the only ecologist. So when we're thinking about managing for regional biodiversity, prioritization, setting your priorities and making sure that you're focusing in the right areas really becomes the key. So I'm going to quickly run through this because I do think this is actually worth at least thinking about as a takeaway from this presentation. So that question, how do we determine where we work? And in thinking about this over the years, I've come to the conclusion that there's really four elements that almost subconsciously go through my mind. It's not like we have some matrix that we plug into and do calculations and figure out where we work, but it's more of a feel, figuring out what are our priorities and opportunities. Four elements that I think are pretty universal in determining this is vulnerability, threats to those species, the probability of the success of your management, and opportunities. And we'll really quickly just go through one by one with these. So that first element, vulnerability. So if we're trying to figure out where we're going to work on the landscape and your mission is rare biodiversity, it kind of inherently makes sense to focus on, perhaps at your first take, the rarest resources that you're dealing with. Your rarest species, the species right on the edge of being lost. That makes sense. It's kind of obvious. But then there's the second level of concentration of rare resources. So if we have the opportunity to work with one rare occurrence on an island over here, or a place over here where 30 of those resources overlap, more than likely, with limited resources, we're going to focus on those areas where they're concentrated, essentially making sure that we get as much value out of the management and our resources as we possibly can. Resources with an inherent vulnerability, I think this is something that could be a presentation unto itself, and I get really excited about, so I'm going to almost skip this. But it's basically saying that resources that may not be your most vulnerable to being lost at the moment, but there's some aspect of their life history that makes them vulnerable. And if that aspect changes, then suddenly you're looking at a crash in a population. So I view these as places where you can be proactive, you can get ahead of the issue, and essentially catch these resources before they become on the cusp of being lost. So assume that you've gone through that first pass, you found your most rare resources that you feel you really need to address. The second element that we really should be considering in determining how and where we work is, what are the threats to those really vulnerable resources? And as I alluded to earlier, there's two primary threats that I deal with just about every day. The first is the interference of natural disturbance regimes, and this almost exclusively across the state means fire. Fire might be a good subject for a future lecture series, because it is so important to our landscape historically, and it's often very overlooked. And just very briefly, this photo on the left is a photo of an interior pine barren, which is a globally rare ecosystem. Fire dependent. You can see pitch pine and heath here. These are the elements that make this up. And it's a system that supports a real range of globally rare biodiversity that's centered on the coastal plain, essentially from New Jersey up through New England. This is also a system that hasn't seen fire in about 70 years. So you can see the elements that are functioning in here, the remnants, but you can see all these generalists, white pine, red maple coming up. This is something that's playing across the landscape all through these ecosystems, and it's essentially a function of, at this point, non-management. So fire suppression became really an important aspect of our culture around the 1920s. Fire was removed from the landscape, and ever since we've seen rapid degradation of these fire-influenced communities. But invasives is the other one that I really deal with constantly. So if you're talking about a vulnerable resource and you're talking about threats, this is all bittersweet. That's overwhelming an important natural community in Stockbridge. It's kind of hard to look at that photo and not see, okay, there's a threat here. There's something happening, and it's changing this landscape and threatening, making that speak a threat to that resource. So you've identified your resources. You've identified the threats. One of the most important aspects of figuring out how you're going to work, and I think it's often one of the most overlooked, is determining, if we were going to do something about these issues, what is our probability of success? Can we actually be successful and achieve what we're setting out to achieve, and at what cost? Again, that seems really obvious, and I think a lot of what I'm saying tonight is really obvious, but sometimes it just kind of needs to be stated, so we're conscious of it, and we're thinking about it, and we're applying it to all of our decision-making. You could have a really rare resource, identify the threat, you could put all your resources into it to manage that and try to bring it back, but if you're thinking about these resources on a statewide level, you really need to assess, is that where we need to be focusing? Is that distracting us from other opportunities that we need to be taking? Essentially constantly questioning yourself and making sure that your goals and objectives are appropriate. And this fourth element here is opportunities. And this one it's really obvious too, but I put it in there because often I also see when we set goals and priorities, we can become very rigid and we can get very wedded to what we've laid out and what we said we're going to do. But sometimes there's opportunities to address something that may not be your rarest occurrence across the state, may not be your highest priority, but suddenly there's a funding source or there's a project partner that's willing to carry most of the weight. Or it could be as simple as, well, I'm going to this really important project and this site is on the way, so I can take care of it. And essentially get two management actions done for the price of one. Just always thinking about how can we stretch our resources and how we can focus and being flexible to take advantage of opportunities as they come up. If you go through all these elements and then you've actually identified your projects and then it's time to work. So we've finally got to invasives. And really quick, because I think this is probably the fourth in the series. We probably have an idea that invasives are bad. We understand that. So I kind of want to get a little bit deeper into that. But real quick, what is an invasive? I like U.S. Forest Service definition. It's they define it as a species that's non-native to an ecosystem that can cause harm. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. This is a graph that shows why they're bad. I'm just going to skip that because you can see why it's bad. And this is pretty obvious. So this is what Phragmites and what a lot of invasive species do to a landscape. So these gray kind of tan stalks here, that's Phragmites. You can see they create these monocultures. They just really overwhelm the native system. This green in here, that's a native sedge. I think there's another one over in here somewhere. You see your biodiversity almost automatically gone. And I think this photo is also kind of important to show one of the often overlooked aspects of invasive species and what it does to biodiversity. It's this thatch on the bottom. This is the previous years and decades of previous years, dead Phragmites on the ground. What's happening here is it doesn't really decompose, because if you think about why are invasive plants in particular so successful? One of the reasons is they don't have natural predators. Natural predators with most of our endangered plants are going to be insects. So if we don't have insects attacking these plants, you essentially have lost your food web. These are very sterile environments. And the reason this thatch is building up, even below the insect level, decomposition is not happening because this is a plant and plant material that's been introduced into a system where it didn't co-evolve with all these other elements. So you can see everything is out of balance and your biodiversity just plummets, not only because it's being overcrowded, but like I say, even that food web disappears from these systems. So this is actually my favorite part. This is almost a thought exercise. Not really sure where this fits in, but I think it's an important aspect of consideration when we think about invasive species and how they fit onto the landscape. And I think anyone who's been working in landscape management, restoration ecology, has sort of come to this conclusion at some point in their career. But I've actually never heard this articulated before. And it kind of came to me a couple years ago, and I realized, oh, this is actually a really big deal, and it's something that's happening on the landscape. And that is this idea that we may never again be able to watch the uninterrupted progression of succession. So that's a lot of words. What does that mean? That sounds kind of weird. I'll take you through it real quick, and I think you'll see just how invasives are impacting the landscape on a macro level. They've really changed the way that our local world has been working. So when I say succession, I'm talking, and this is in very general terms, some ecologists would freak out to hear this definition, but I think it works for what we're talking about. I'm defining succession for this as the typical progression from open landscapes to wooded. So if you think about a farm pasture, and when it's abandoned, it goes through a natural progression of succession. It's going to go from pasture to meadow to shrubland to woodland to forest. And these photos show that. So this photo here on the left is about a 120-year-old forest. It's beautiful. It's mature trees, lots of structural diversity, closed canopy. Looks like it's always been there. But then you see the stone wall and you realize, no, 100 years or more ago, this was open pasture. This almost guaranteed went through that natural progression of succession. This was a woodland, this was a shrubland, this was a meadow, it eventually became what it is. Photo on the right showing the same thing was just a different signifier. It's what we refer to as a wolf tree. This is a tree that was open grown when this was a pasture, and we can see that the forest grew up around it. You think about the vast majority of forest land in Massachusetts, it was mostly agricultural and open at one point. The vast majority of our landscape has gone through the natural progression of succession. And I think a really good illustration of what I would consider a high-integrity forest would be this example here, Maple Hill in West Stockbridge, and it's showing a climax-type rich mesic forest, which a rich mesic forest is one of those natural communities that we really care about. You can see 100-year-old sugar maple here reaching up into the canopy. You can see this beautiful ground cover of spring ephemerals, blue cohosh and maidenhair fern. It's really fantastic assemblage of biodiversity. And when it all comes together in places like this, a really actually rare occurrence, and there's a lot of rare species associated with these habitats. So Maple Hill in West Stockbridge. Well, this photo is also Maple Hill in West Stockbridge. This photo is terrible, right? This is all invasives. You can see the bittersweet just hanging over these treetops. You can see trees that are pulled down by the vines of bittersweet. You can see this understory. It's all multiflora rose. This is an ecological disaster. And if you become familiar with these kind of landscapes, you know without intervention, this will always look like this. The interesting part of this to me, and getting back to the original point that I'm hopefully making, is this photo and this photo, extreme differences. These are about 700 feet apart on the landscape. So the same area, they're on the same slope, same elevation, same aspect, same hydrology, same soil conditions, same relative landscape use history. Pretty much everything is the same. But what's the difference? The difference is this was abandoned about 100 years ago before invasive species were prevalent on the landscape. So this was able to go through that natural progression of succession from pasture land into forest. This was abandoned, we figure, around the 1970s, at a time when invasives were widespread across the landscape. The natural progression of succession here was interrupted by invasive species. So, okay, that's interesting, but what does it mean? Well, the reality is this is happening now pretty much everywhere, and essentially we will never be able to walk away from an open piece of land again and have it turn into this. Almost invariably, it's going to turn into this, which means that succession, which is a primary fundamental aspect of ecology, it's the how things go from one state to the next. It's the reason that most of our forests look the way they do if they're healthy in the state. That will probably never happen again because that progression of succession is now going to be almost invariably interrupted any time it tries to happen. And without intervention, if you were to come back to this site in 50 years, 100 years, it's still going to look the same. It's never going to become a forest. And most of our lands that are in an early successional state that have been disturbed, have been abandoned, are not going to turn into this anymore. They're going to turn into this. So to step back and think about, okay, invasives, what does that mean? It's thinking also on the large scale. So a lot of what I'm talking about is kind of small scale. We're thinking about rare species occurrences, how we're going to fix those. But this is how it's impacting it on a large scale. We've pretty much lost this fundamental part of forest ecology and forest function. So kind of just something to think about, something kind of horrifying to think about, but it's context. So I'm going to kind of finish up here, and I think we actually might be okay on time, with three case studies. And it's a slide that I skipped earlier, but I think that's fine because we can explain why I chose these three to go through. And this is a case study of dealing with invasive species in an area of high ecological value and very vulnerable, very rare resources. This is Agawam Lake in Stockbridge. And if you're from the area, you might have actually seen some of this work. This was on Route 7 between Stockbridge and Great Barrington. And you'll see I have the term eradication here. So what I'm trying to convey here was within that earlier slide that there's essentially a choice that you have to make when you're about to deal with invasive species control. What are your goals and objectives? And there's basically three categories of projects that you're going to be taking on. Eradication, when you're getting rid of all the invasives in a site. Control, when you've sort of accepted the fact I can't get rid of everything at the site, but I can reduce the presence of the invasives and restore ecosystem function, but I'm just going to have to live for whatever reason with invasives in that environment. And the third is containment. I'm going to show an example of each as we go through. But this is Agawam Lake. And this is one of our most special places in the entire state, calcareous basin fen. So this is an area with these upwellings coming up through the marble, highly calcareous, very high pH, and very unusual and very harsh ecosystems. It's interesting. So when we talk about rare species, a lot of people think, oh, they're rare, they're in these really fragile niches, they must be kind of weak. And it's actually, in many cases, it's the opposite. They're exploiting niches that other things simply cannot live in. So here they're living in very alkalized, calcium-rich places, places that most plants cannot exist. So when you have all these things coming together, this is a very rare ecosystem, and therefore, and it's also very harsh, therefore the species associated with it by default are rare because there's not a lot of this habitat out there. What this photo is showing is we're actually measuring native Phragmites, which in itself is very rare, only from a handful of places in the state, and this is one of them. And there's also a wide range of rare plants and animals, especially invertebrates, associated with this site. So if we want to go back to prioritization, how we look at this, vulnerability of the resource, this ranks very high. This is a globally rare ecosystem, loaded with invasives, with very rare species, highly specialized species, makes that first pass. This is a place that we want to make sure is functioning properly, and if there's management needs, we want to be working there. You determine if there's management needs, we think about that second element, the threats. Well, this is non-native Phragmites, pretty clearly a threat to this ecosystem. And Agawam Lake has a fairly bad non-native Phragmites issue here. So considering how important this landscape is, and considering that this threat could really change the entire landscape, we decided that, yes, this is a place that we need to take a closer look at. So if we go back to this idea of the four elements, we've determined these things. Well, can we actually do something about it? Does it make sense for us to actually invest resources here? And you look at that, and that looks pretty horrible. And there's actually 55 acres of Phragmites like this at this site. And to a lot of people's surprise, our answer was, yes, we can actually do something about this in this case. So we decided to work here because it's so important and because we thought we could actually achieve positive results at the site. So our first step was to actually very precisely define what those threats were. We knew it was Phragmites, so we went out and we actually mapped every occurrence of Phragmites. Each one of these yellow polygons, and they total 55 acres, is a very discrete, non-native Phragmites monoculture. And that's the way that Phragmites grows, and that's one of the reasons why we thought we would have success here. We were using that to our advantage. Each one of these polygons is essentially one plant. Phragmites is a plant that spreads through rhizomes, underground stems that act essentially like roots. So they very quickly, one plant will dominate an entire ecosystem. So we figured that gives us, when we're doing chemical control, that actually gives us a big advantage in taking on a situation like this. So we decided to put this out to bid because it was such a big job we couldn't do it internally. In the first year, we hired two individual contractors, separate companies, to take this on by foot. Took them 3 weeks total, which is a long time working every day. It was horrible work. Very difficult. 100-pound packs of chemicals on your back, walking through these hummocks. But they did a fantastic job. and they actually controlled about 99% of the Phragmites in the first pass through here. They also said they would never do this work again because it was so difficult, and I couldn't disagree with them, and I felt not only bad for them, but a little distressed because what are we going to do about this area on the west side? It's bigger, it's harder to get to. I didn't want to leave the job half finished. In thinking this through, one contractor actually approached me and said, well, you know, I have this amphibious vehicle. I could drive it over there and I could treat all of that. And I thought to myself, well, that's crazy. This is a globally rare, highly sensitive place. Why would we drive essentially a tank on this? It doesn't make sense to me. But the more we talked about it, the more I realized that I was actually wrong. These are low pressure vehicles. And the contractor really worked with us with the specs and talked about this. A vehicle like this only puts down 1 pound of pressure per square foot on the ground. The typical human adult standing has 7 pounds. So in theory, this is actually lighter than a person. I felt pretty good about that, and we looked into it more. The point being, again, going back to flexibility, not getting too ingrained in your conclusions and too wedded to your objectives and your outcomes, and making sure that you're actually leaving openings so you can actually be effective and impactful. So we actually went to the Conservation Commission in town and said, we really want to do this. We think it makes sense. We worked with them, and they allowed for the use of this vehicle. They did this remaining 35 acres in 2 days and achieved the same results. And the cost was actually about 20% of the overall cost that it took to do just this much. So we learned a lot by doing this. And there's a better slide coming up, but this is the high integrity sedge mat in that fen. This is just a band of cattails, which is a different story. And this is what one section of this looks like right here. All this dead is dead Phragmites. And this is one of my favorite slides of all time. This is showing what happens when we do this work. So all of these dead things here, this is dead Phragmites, about 100% killed. This is one growing season after the treatment. All the green you see is not only just native vegetation coming through, this is specific to that rare natural community. So this is highly specialized. In many cases, these are actually rare species that have been suppressed by the Phragmites for decades. Within one growing season, this is what it looks like. It's almost instant gratification, and a lot of people were highly skeptical of this project, and then they saw the results and said, okay, this makes a lot of sense. The chemicals scared people, but this really brings it home. The scale of the project, and when you see that we can actually achieve our goals, it really changed a lot of minds about how we take on these projects. One final note about this, you keep hearing me saying eradication for this, and 99% control. One thing that's really important about invasive species projects is that they are continuous. They don't have a shelf life. So people say, well, how long is that going to take you to do that? And I'll say forever, because you cannot walk away from a project like this. Our goal with this project was to use a lot of resources up front, hire contractors, get this under control, and get it to a stage where our staff can come in and reasonably manage it. So reducing this threat by about 95%, and then we just visit the site every year or every other year and clean up to make sure that this doesn't go back to the way it was before. So I'm about at time. I just want to give one more example because I think this is kind of the opposite way of looking at it, and I do think it's interesting. So we talked about there's three ways to approach a project. There's eradication, there's control, which control is just essentially living with some invasives on the property, but knowing you're having ecosystem function, so that's okay. But I think this third one is pretty interesting, and it's containment. And this is a pretty brief example. So the photo is of Mount Tom in Holyoke, one of our most important ecosystems in the entire state, I would argue even New England. It's an amazing place. And this sedge here is Carex glaucodia, endangered in the state, rare across its entire range. And in Massachusetts, it's only found in a handful of places. And Mount Tom is the stronghold for the population. So pretty small plant, a little bit inconspicuous, but very important if you're thinking about rare regional biodiversity. in our mind, worth working with because it's highly vulnerable, but there's also a really serious threat here. So this is a natural glade community in Mount Tom, beautiful hickory and open sedimentary rock coming through, so really interesting chemical and mineral influence on the plant community, except this entire understory is black swallowwort, which is invasive. And not only in these glades, there's literally hundreds of contiguous acres of black swallowwort. And if you were to step off of Mount Tom along the I-91 corridor, there's over 1,000 acres of this black swallowwort here. You can see how quickly this would overwhelm and essentially extinguish this diminutive sedge that's growing here. There's no way we could control this for multiple reasons. The scale, the life history of this plant, and even the way that it functions on the landscape, it has windborne seeds. If we were to clear an area of this the next year, those thousands of acres would just pour more seeds. We would constantly be chasing this. So unfortunately, I don't have a photo of what this looks like, but we decided the plant was important enough to conserve, so we went for a containment strategy. Essentially what that means is we went through this area where this plant occurs. We found every occurrence of the plant. We flagged it, and now it's been 10 years. We've been going back to the site every year and doing a 1 meter radius around every plant, treating that with herbicide. And if you were to look at this from above, you would see these perfect circles around all these plants. Now, that's not ecosystem function. That's not ideal, but that's being realistic. That's saying we have this really important resource. We can't do much more than this, but we can at least keep that plant persisting on the landscape and use it, our actions as a placeholder. So until we find a better way to treat this regional problem of black swallowwort, that rare biodiversity will exist and persist. So containment, essentially keeping the threat at bay until we can figure out a better way to address the situation. So final thoughts about invasives. We'll just go through this very quickly. Early detection, rapid response. That's really the key when we're thinking about invasives, getting to the issue as soon as possible. Not only does it make control more realistic, but you're also losing less of those rare resources to the invasive. There's more left to actually save if you get to the problem early. Goals, and we've talked about that pretty thoroughly. Understanding that herbicides are a tool, I think this is a really important one. There's a lot of people who are leery of herbicides. I'm actually one of them, but on the other hand, every day almost, I'm thinking about herbicides and how I'm going to be responsible for their application on the landscape, because herbicides are a critical tool and in many cases the only tool for treating invasives, even in these highly sensitive areas. We use a very limited suite of herbicides that are very safe, and after 16 years of doing this, I can honestly say there's never been a situation where I've looked at a product and thought, wow, I really wish I didn't use that. If anything, it's the opposite. I wish we were actually more aggressive early on. I'm happy to talk about herbicides, but I've sort of been convinced that I have not seen ecological damage, and we really couldn't do what we do without herbicides. Sort of going along in that, don't fear working in wetlands. This is something that I think we really have to overcome as a culture. We love wetlands, which is fantastic, but we kind of have this impression that they're so sensitive that we can't go there, we can't do work in them, we can't manage them, and that's simply not true. If we look at that Agawam Lake, that's one of the most sensitive ecosystems we have in the state. As long as you're thoughtful, you plan it through, and really think about what you're doing, because the opposite of working in those wetlands is inaction. And if you have something threatening that wetland, and you don't want to go in there because it's sensitive, you're going to lose those resources anyway. Invasives projects are long-term, right? You can't just walk away from them. Between seed banking and coming in, you're always dealing with it. And, of course, prevention is always the first priority. And just one last slide, climate change, because it's a question that I get almost daily. What are we doing for climate change? Well, in my perspective, the most important thing that I can do for climate change, actually thinking about our actions on the landscape, is building resilience into these landscapes. Essentially, and if we're talking invasive species, removing those stressors from the landscape, allowing optimal landscape function, is going to give that landscape and that ecosystem a real leg up and give it a chance to at least adapt as things change around it. And that's where we are, and I'm happy to talk about this all night if people have questions or comments. Yeah.
You mentioned fire as being like one of the natural disruptors. How hard is it to obtain, or like at least go through the protocol to actually utilize a controlled burn?
That's a great question, and it's something that we're really dealing with right now at our program. We've actually are hiring a specific fire manager for that reason. So fire is, there's two aspects to it. There's sort of that cultural aspect where people have to overcome that fear. So getting fire on the ground can be very difficult. And then there's the logistics of fire. So for that first aspect, that cultural aspect, we've actually come a long way in the last decade or so. Our program at the state, we do a lot of prescribed fire, a lot of nonprofits are, but there's the reason we've been able to do that is there's very tight protocols on that. Has to be certified burn plans, has to go through the fire chiefs, and it's also expensive. So that's the other aspect, is the logistical part of it. It's a great question, there's no real easy answer, but the point I think I would make is if your organization is dedicated to fire, you really have to focus on it, but if you can do that and dedicate staff to it, dedicate resources to it, and really drop your priorities, it can be a really important part of your management regime. There's not a ton of prescribed fire going on in the landscape right now for those reasons. It's mostly in the southeast, Cape Cod and the islands, but we're building programs out. So it's almost a cultural question more than anything, and building capacity. I don't know if that helps you, but...
I want to ask about, I guess it's a process question in your work. And some, Eglon Lake is a state wildlife management area.
It is.
So why, what's the process of having to go to the town commission, conservation commission?
That's a great question. So the conservation commission is basically an outgrowth of the Department of Environmental Protection, DEP. And they are responsible for essentially wetlands protection across the state, the Wetlands Protection Act. So regardless of landowner, any work that happens in a wetland has to go through DEP and DEP permitting. So for the example of Agawam Lake, we are the landowner. And as the heritage program, we have the sole authority for rare species. So we can make all of those decisions, but DEP has sole authority over wetlands permitting. The Conservation Commission is sort of the local outreach of DEP. And it's kind of interesting how they put it. DEP is centralized, but they've given a lot of powers to the individual towns and commissions. So we have to actually go through both entities. We have to go through DEP and the town to get our permits. So we essentially say, this is what we're looking to do. This is how we're going to do it. We have to file, get a permit, has to be discussed, and they essentially decide whether we're allowed to do it or not. So, Wetlands Protection Act.
And a follow-up to that. Do you find, in working with these different conservation commissions in different towns, what makes for a successful experience in your view of working with these?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's always amazed me that every commission is different, so it's a law. But how that law is interpreted is different in every town across the state. So there's some towns where we almost know, don't bother, we're not going to get anything. So to answer specifically your question, it's, I don't want to be derogatory, but I would say it's an open-minded commission who's really interested in what you're doing and is willing to almost cede some of that control and trust your expertise. I think one example, I was at the Hardwick Conservation Commission last night, actually talking about a project. And I explained the project to them. It was a little unorthodox because every one of these projects is kind of unique. They hadn't dealt with anything like that before, but they got really excited about it because they could see, okay, our mission is very similar to their mission. I think the short answer to your question is sort of this willingness and this eagerness to actually just, we described it as, or it was described to me by one of the commissioners last night, we're more interested in enforcing the spirit of the law than the letter of the law. They could see what we were doing. They could see that it made sense. They could see that it was a net benefit to the resource. It was a little unorthodox, but they trusted us and they actually approved the project. So kind of this open-mindedness and this sort of bigger picture, I find, really makes a difference in the Conservation Commission and how they approach projects.
I want to ask about the Glaucodia, or the carrots, Glaucodia.
Yep.
You're spraying around every individual plant every year. Thinking about one of the criteria, probability of success.
Right.
When do you say, this is too much, we can't sustain it, or what?
So that's exactly the process that we go through with the thought. And in this specific case, being that this is really the only meaningful population in the state, and in reality, it's two staff peoples, one day in the field. So it's not a huge investment. And the alternative is essentially doing nothing. And if we do that, we know we're going to lose that population. And functionally, that species would be extirpated from the state. If this was 2 weeks of staff time, it may be a different conclusion. So it's that constant cost-benefit analysis. This plant is so rare, and this is about herbicides and what a tool they are. We're actually using an herbicide that does not impact sedges and grasses. So what we're seeing is the native sedge community, including this rare one, is really thriving where we're spraying. So we're getting a lot of success. We feel relatively small amount of resources are going into this, and the alternative is to lose the species from the state. So we feel that all those things considered, it's actually a worthwhile project. But it's something that we really talk a lot about and try to figure out.
And to follow up on that, are these tools in your toolkit to translocate or reintroduce populations or move them into botanical gardens and things like that?
That's always an option. But I think if I was to back up a little bit, we do that. But we also have this philosophy that we're never looking at it, or we're rarely looking at it as an issue with a single species. It's always this community. And it's kind of no coincidence. We're talking about Mount Tom in this example. This natural community is really important, and there's a lot of other rare species in this natural community. It's an interesting example because you're kind of pointing out that gray area where we're working right now. What I'm saying is, for this species, if we were to give up on this, not only would we lose this species as part of this landscape where it naturally occurred, we would essentially be giving up on this landscape. So we're looking at this as, even though it's been 10 years, it may be another 10 years, in the scheme of things, this is really short term, and we're really doing this action as a placeholder until we can think of a better way or a better tool comes up and we can manage this. And that's probably biocontrol, which I didn't bring up because it's a whole other issue, but it's essentially introducing a predator for the invasive target. And it's being worked on now with swallowwort, and something like that would be a game changer. So, you know, thinking about that context, you know, is there hope on the horizon? There actually might be. And it is partially philosophical. We could put these strictly in botanical gardens, but then we have zoos of rare species and not actual ecosystems. So it's really, I don't want to say it's a last resort, but it is only one part of what we do is augmentation or translocation. We're really also thinking about landscapes. This is an extreme example, by the way. This is the only place that we do something like this. So we're actually thinking about the exception here, but that helps.
What factors kind of come into play when it comes to like success rates? So say if you want to eradicate a certain species in the area, mm-hmm. what like factors such as endangered species in the areas, kind of how the landscape is laid out, like what factors come into play when determining a success rate?
Yeah, so we're really looking at, I think it comes down to more the life history of the invasive more than the landscape. So the Phragmites is a good example where that was high intensity across the landscape, but our strategy was to take advantage of its life history. And, you know, the way that it's basically one big plant, if we apply herbicide in late summer when it's drying down, it's going to attack that rhizome. That's how we determine eradication in that perspective. For other species like the black swallowwort, acreage-wise, that's not that different than the Phragmites situation, but the life history of this plant is so different that each individual plant is an individual. It seed banks so well, it's wind dispersed. So it's really, very most often, that decision is really tied to the life history of the actual invasive that we're treating. And can we take advantage of that life history, or is that life history actually going to be a limiting factor? That's the primary thing that we're looking at. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I was trying to think. So say if you couldn't use your most successful rate, how do you determine your next, like, how would you go on to your next plan of action? Plan B.
Plan B.
Well, I think then in a situation like that, to use the Agawam Lake scenario, because I think it might work for this, if it wasn't Phragmites, but if it was, say, barberry, something that we knew we couldn't eradicate, then we would fall back. Okay, we know we can't eradicate this from the landscape. So it's kind of a question of looking at where do we want to contain this, right? Where do we really care about where it is and is not? And then at what level can we live within the ecosystem? Now, there's never going to be a number, but it's determining, for that example, we would be protecting the core of the natural community, and it might be eradication in that spot, and just control around it to make sure that it's not constantly seeping in and reinfecting it. So every situation is different. It could be zones. It could be hot spots of targets where you're going. But it's more approach than it is actually defining it by hard numbers, if that helps you. Yeah, it's hard to answer because every single situation is different. Yeah. But it's always sort of evaluating resources in terms of, is there a huge difference between eradication versus control? If there is, then we go to control, I mean, to put it simply.
So I guess to follow up on that, are there any places that you've looked at and you've seen that, oh, it would be good to work here, but not everything lines up, so you have to just kind of walk away from the site and not do anything?
Yeah, it happens all the time. And actually, one of the examples that I skipped, if we have just a second, was that Agawam Lake scenario. And Agawam Lake was a scenario that we decided that we were going to treat because we owned it, we had access to it, we could move pretty quickly, and we could deal with it. What you're not seeing is, if you can picture Agawam Lake here on this side of Route 7, this is Route 7, this is Concapot, and I skipped over this, but I think this is kind of interesting, it'll be very brief. Same type of community, same issues. We decided not to work on this side for several reasons. One of the main reasons was we didn't own this. This is a conglomeration of different landowners. So permitting, permissions, we just couldn't react fast enough. And kind of the sad outcome to that is we surveyed and mapped out the Phragmites in 2010, and I really wanted to work here. I thought this was a really important spot. This is an American bittern here, which is an endangered short marsh bird in the state. This is one of our best occurrences in the state. A lot of other things going on. 2012, I still really wanted to work here. I went back and mapped this out, and the Phragmites just exploded. You can see the difference to the point that it's almost irrecoverable at this point in just two seasons. So that's an example where we couldn't move fast enough for essentially permitting and landowner issues. We had to table it. We wanted to work there. We just couldn't put it together. And that's actually the title of the slide, The Price of Inaction. That's kind of what happens. And really sadly, this is a view from Route 7, all the tan you see. And this is literally a 3-mile-long wetland. It's all Phragmites monoculture now. So we do that all the time. I mean, those are the really hard choices that we have to make, seeing statewide mission with really, really limited resources. It's why I really kind of focus on making priorities up front in the beginning, because that's something that we really have to think about constantly. Yeah, it's a good point.
Thank you, Chris.
Oh, thank you.